public safety officer or a person who qualifies as a dependent of the public safety officer for tax purposes, so it can be stepchildren as well.
Okay, thank you.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Ackerman.
Yeah, just a question. If this seems to be some extension of benefits, how do we know, or how does the public know from an actuarial standpoint if this fund is solvent, or if, you know, these benefits that might be increased might impair the solvency of the fund?
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, this fund is actually subject, any disbursements are subject to the amount of funds that are available. At this point in time, it only receives $500,000 per biennium. It is looking, obviously, to find a funding mechanism to increase that over time, which will probably be some fundraising that will go on. This past biennium, I believe we were close to $300,000 that were given out in benefits, but that had retroactive to 1997. But at this point in time, this particular board has to make that assessment within that finite budget as to what can be funded. And so the only thing that was actually added was the clarification that the officer that was totally disabled could also receive benefits, rather than just the family of a deceased officer.
You have a follow-up, Representative?
Well, I'm just worried about a lot of these funds that seemingly go off budget, and, you know, there's either no oversight or, in your case, maybe no actuarial basis for what we're doing, and I'm worried that that might create contractual obligations, which would be beyond the ability of the fund to support at some time and then come back to legislature for relief. That may not be the point of this bill, but I think it gets there if we're expanding benefits and there's not adequate oversight. I'm just raising that issue with a number of budgets I find that are just totally off budget. You know, we don't have any legislative oversight, so to speak.
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, the board that monitors this particular committee has been concerned about that same thing and has begun to do some actuarial studies. They have looked at the insurance portion of it, and they know that the fund would outstrip itself by 2020 is what the prediction is, but they also know by the time they hit scholarships that will happen. So they are working this interim to look at what each of those different benefits are, to come forward and decide what it will take long term to fund this and how they might go about doing that. But presently the statute does restrict them to only making benefits as funds are available. So that ends the fund if there are no funds available.
Thank you.
Further questions? Yes, Representative Ringo.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I was just wondering a little bit about the purpose behind the Memorial Fund. Obviously, there's already workers' comp in place, and it appears that this is an additional, out of gratitude, I suppose, for people who are conducting dangerous work, and that's why perhaps it's appropriate that they receive an additional payment. Is that fair?
Sure, Williams, Representative Ringo. Part of the thinking behind this bill when it was passed was that there's often a lag of time before officers or surviving families get their benefits, and the initial benefit was designed to make sure they had money immediately to take care of necessary items. The rest was...
I'm sorry, just Mr. Chair. The lag of benefits is in the payment of workers' comp benefits?
Chair Williams, Representative Ringo, no, I'm speaking mostly of other survivor benefits that are available to officers. I believe this was designed to be in addition to any kind of workers' compensation benefit. Beyond that, I'm not totally sure what the whole thinking was behind the bill when it was established.
If I could, Representative Ringo, this was created last session under Representative Shetterly's tutelage of the Civil Judiciary Committee. It was Representative Westland's, one of his priority bills, as I recall. We had a number of hearings throughout quite a period of the session, working on the bill and defining what benefits would and would not be included. But there was a reasonably compelling case from a number of family members of fallen officers who came in and talked about the period of time in which the person was without the ability, the surviving spouse, for example, was without the ability to have the resources available to deal with their obligations while the process went forward with the survivor benefits eventually being paid. So it was in some ways, I think, a gesture towards public safety officers recognizing the risk that they put themselves into for the public, to find a mechanism that would accelerate some period of benefits and also provide a scholarship fund eventually if the resources were available for their, for the children of those surviving officers. Further questions? Okay. Thank you, Diane. Is there anyone else here who would like to testify on Senate Bill 366? Okay, we'll close the public hearing and we'll open a work session on Senate Bill 366.
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 366 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lowe moves Senate Bill 366A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. I had to check to make sure there wasn't any. To the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion on her motion? Okay. Call the roll.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Backman?
Aye.
Representative Dinkfelder?
Aye.
Representative Ringo?
Aye.
Representative Taylor?
Aye.
Representative Chair Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Krieger?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lowe?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Senate Bill 366A moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Representative Krieger, would you carry the bill? Okay. We're now going to open a work session on Senate Bill 290A. Counselor.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 290A comes to you from the Department of Public Safety Training and Standards, allows the Department of Public Safety Standards and Training to adopt rules specifying effective criminal convictions upon certification as a public safety officer or instructor. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, you have the Dash 3 amendments in front of you, which allows a person to keep his or her certification as a private security officer to, despite a person's, actually the Dash 4 amendments,
right.
And allows the DPSC to allow rules specifying the effect of criminal convictions upon certification as a private security officer. These amendments would be mirror image or similar to the ones for public safety officers.
Diane, do you want to come up? We had, as I recall, when we had this bill up last time, we had Senator Deckert who came in, and there were some amendments which they had presented, which I think raised concerns, if I recall, for DPSST. You worked out the Dash 4 amendments as a compromise, is that right?
Chair Williams, we have. And I did misspeak myself when I was here last time on this. I was thinking the original bill covered the public or the private security, and it did not. So this takes care of that and will allow us to address Senator Decker's concerns.
Okay. Are there questions for Ms. Middle about either the amendments or the original bill?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
I guess you want this authority. Is that right? I mean, you, in some respects, I guess it's easier to have it in statute where you can just say, sorry, that's the law. But you want this authority, so you'll have people coming to you for rule changes from time to time to accommodate this individual or that individual and having to say no or yes?
Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, it's kind of, I don't know, it's a catch-22 sort of. It's nice to have the firmness of the statutes. On the other hand, this allows the board to update each session at the close of the session with the new laws, and they can do that by administrative rule process. So in many respects, it's easier. It allows them a little more flexibility at the same time that makes it a little bit more difficult for them to maintain standards. But it's a trade-off, and both the board and the department and the advisory committees are very much in support of doing it this way.
Diane, I guess I'd just say it is a fundamental policy change for us to essentially pass the authority to you or to the board to make the determination as to who which crimes do and don't result in revocation or certification. And I guess I'd just, based on some of the testimony we heard last time about illegal hay hauling and a few other things that were on that list, I guess I would feel appropriate to admonish the board to carefully monitor the nexus of the crimes that are included as a disqualifier
I think all of us are very cognizant of the fact that we want the people who are serving in law enforcement and in public safety to have impeccable records and to be of the highest quality and caliber. At the same time, I think we don't want to see people who have maybe, you know, some period of time earlier in their life been convicted of the heinous crime of illegal hay hauling to potentially deny their opportunity to serve as a public safety officer. And I guess I would be interested in asking you at some point in the interim to come back and tell the Interim Judiciary Committee what rules, in fact, have been adopted and what people, based on which crimes, have actually been excluded as a way for us to sort of check back up on how this process and this transfer of authority is working. Is that acceptable to you?
Chair Williams, it certainly is, and I can assure you that the board takes it seriously. In fact, the hay hauling has never been one of those crimes, but and I don't imagine it will be. The Police Advisory Committee, just for your information, worked extremely diligently, actually prior to and bringing the original Senate Bill 290 forward, and it was long and agonizing, but it was good work that was done by the committee, and they did spend a lot of time talking about how that relates to the actual jobs, the underlying jobs, which I think is the important discussion to have.
Right.
But I'd be very happy to report back to an interim.
Great. That would be good. Okay. Well, with that, then the chair would move. Unless are there further questions for Ms. Middle? Thank you, Diane. The chair would move the adoption of the A4 amendments to Senate Bill 290. Is there any discussion? Any objection? The A4s are adopted. The chair would move Senate Bill 290 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Call the roll.
Representative Ackerman?
Aye.
Representative Backlund?
Aye.
Representative Dingfelder?
Aye.
Representative Ringo?
Aye.
Representative Shetterly?
Aye.
Representative Cheryl Walker?
Aye.
Vice Chair Peters?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lowe?
Aye.
Chair Williams?
Aye. Senate Bill 290 as amended moves to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Volunteer carrier on this one?
I'll take it.
Representative Ackerman? Thank you. Okay, we're now going to go into work session on Senate Bill 133. As I indicated, colleagues, it is not my intention to actually move this bill today. This is simply because of the plethora of amendments being offered to Senate Bill 133, give the committee an opportunity to consider the amendments today by discussion, and then it would be my preference, although it's not necessarily within my control, but it would be my preference that we actually not move amendments into the bill today, but simply consider the ones that are being put forward and then take up the actual movement of amendments into the bill in tomorrow's meeting. So with that, Council, why don't we talk about the original bill, and then we'll start talking about amendments.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Senate Bill 133A comes to you from Representative Lowe, and it creates a crime of a felon in possession of body armor and classifies the crime as a Class C felony. It defines what it is as what body armor is. Creates a crime of unlawful possession of body armor if the person, while committing or attempted committing a felony misdemeanor involving violence, knowingly wears body armor. We have numerous amendments to the bill, and as best as possible, I will attempt to go through them because updated versions have arrived this morning, and one additional amendment has also arrived this morning. We have the A5 version, which requires each local public safety coordinating council to establish an early disposition program for first-time offenders. Dale Penn and Ann Christian are here on that, and we have updated amendments since the A5. I think we have two versions of those, and they will discuss the differences between the two, the slight differences, and that I think they would also like to come back to tomorrow with another set of amendments. The A6 amendment exempts from prohibition of possessing body armor a person who has been convicted of only one felony other than homicide and who was discharged from prison, parole, or probation for period of 15 years prior to the date of the alleged violation. You may remember that we had a gentleman testify before the committee who owns a company up in St. Helens that makes, among other things, body armor. And I guess he, a long time ago, over 20 years ago, was convicted of a felony. We which means that he may not be able to make this equipment, and I guess he employs quite a few people in St. Helens. I also know that they make wetsuits and other material like that, kayaking jackets. A7 amendments requires the grand jury proceedings be electronically recorded. Bill Hauser is here on that particular amendment. The A8 amendments establishes a Community Corrections Advisory Committee consisting of 11 members, 5 of them from list of recommendations submitted by the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I think
These
have been withdrawn.
The A8s have been withdrawn.
Then we have the A9 amendments creates offense of vehicular assault of a bicyclist or pedestrian and classifies the offense as a Class A misdemeanor. I think this comes from Representative Beck's aide, and it's similar to proposed amendments that were submitted in the Senate. Then this morning we received the A11 amendments from Representative Carlson. You may remember that some time ago we had a bill before us created a planning and advisory committee to make recommendations on how to increase family bonding for children who have incarcerated parents. Those are all the amendments to the best of my knowledge, Mr. Chair.
Okay. What I'd like to do then is I'm going to give the proponents of the various amendments that are in front of us on Senate Bill 133 an opportunity to come forward. So who is here for the dash A5s? Okay, why don't you come up then? And please identify yourself for the record.
Mr. Chair, for the record, Ann Christian, State Court Administrator's Office. Mr. Chair, the dash A5 will be replaced by what will be probably the dash A14. If I could, to refresh memories, the dash A5 established a requirement for local public safety coordinating councils to create what are called early disposition programs. Lane County has really led the state, and most recently Multnomah County, as far as establishing early disposition programs. The dash 810 amendments are Mr. Penn's amendments, and they replace, I'm trying to make this make sense, and we will have new A14 amendments tomorrow that incorporate changes in the A10s and A13. But Mr. Penn's amendment do one thing. They exclude from early disposition programs Class A and Class B felonies, which I know of no opposition at all to that change to how the early disposition programs would, what they would include. There are, in all of the amendments, I'll call it a savings clause for any early disposition programs that are currently in effect. The one in Multnomah County does include possession of small amounts of drugs, and those could cover Class B felonies, but because the savings clause is safely in here, Mr. Penn's amendments would have no adverse impact on that existing program in Portland. The dash A13 make a simple change, which provides on page 3, line 29, that the court, for good cause shown, can give an extended period of time. The whole notion of early disposition is move cases through the system effectively but also efficiently. And both DAs and defense attorneys thought that there needed to be a little more opportunity for, in a rare case, for example, where a defendant potentially has mental health issues, to allow the court a little bit more discretion to extend the period of time within which that offer from the district attorney is available to the defendant. And so the A5s are gone as far as the proponents are concerned, and the dash A10 and dash A13 amendments, which combined exclude A and B felonies and provide the court with a good cause opportunity for an exception will be put together today, provided council's available into new amendments so they're in one place.
Mr. Penn?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Dale Penn. I'm representing the District Attorney Association. We're very supportive of this bill. We wanted to make it a consensus bill. Had a work group with counties, the court, defense lawyers, DAs represented. As we were presenting this program out to other interested parties, the issue about A and B felonies, although it really wasn't our intent to see very many of those cases ever go through this accelerated program, that became a bit of a sticking point, and so that's why the dash 10s were there to make it real clear. Let's get these programs up and operating and see how they do and get a report before we just say it can apply to our most serious felony crimes in the criminal code. And with that, I don't believe we will have opposition at all to any of these amendments or programs.
Good. Thank you. Any questions for either of these witnesses? Appreciate it. Thank you. Is there anyone here who wishes to speak to the amendments that we don't have yet but are a compilation of the A5, A10s, and A13s? Okay, good. Next would be the A6s, which we had heard about. Mr. Taylor reminded us Representative Betsy Johnson came in with her constituent, Representative Lowe, I think, is the one of the sponsors of the body armor bill. You don't have any objection to the adoption of the A6s when the time comes?
No, what this will do is give a 15-year moratorium on the ability to do that for certain felonies. And then the interesting thing about the gentleman, her constituent, is that, yes, he does make wetsuits and so forth, but they're body armor wetsuits, and he does it for the Coast Guard and SEALs and so forth and quite a few military contracts out there rely on his products. And there are 30 people who need that job in St. Helens. So we were able to accommodate him. He doesn't skate. Actually, he will have an additional waiting period that he has to wait, but he's willing to do that and grateful for this committee's consideration, and I'm in complete accord with the amendment.
Good. Thank you. Are there questions for Representative Lowe about the dash A6s? Okay. The proponents of the A7 amendments, Mr. Hauser.
Thank you, Chair Williams. My name is Bill Hauser. I'm with the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. One of the high-priority agenda items for our organization was grand jury reform this session, but comes to you in the A7, the dash A7 amendments, is the stripped-down version of our reform request. What it requires is the recording of the grand jury proceedings that would include the charge by the court, the taking of testimony, any other comments by the district attorney in front of the grand jury, but does not include the deliberation of the grand jury. We understand, in our government as we have it right now, about the last vestige of secrecy in our government is the grand jury proceeding. Most all of other government action is done in the light of day, similar to what we're doing here today. We understand that while we might like to have the grand jury proceeding in an open forum, we understand that there are some public policy reasons why we can't do that. And so what we're asking the committee to consider is that rather than open the grand jury proceedings up and make it an open proceeding, we allow for the recording of those proceedings so that we can have some checks and balances on the grand jury proceeding. And frankly, not just the grand jury, but the executive branch of government that is in effect controlling the grand jury proceeding. That by recording the testimony and having a mechanism so that defense counsel can have an opportunity to review that if they feel they need to during the course of the defense of their client. That's basically the reason why we're asking for the amendment. We ask that you favorably consider that amendment, and I'd be willing to answer any questions you might have.
Are there questions for Mr. Hauser about the A7 amendment? Yes, Representative Cheryl Walker.
Chair Williams, thank you. Mr. Hauser, I've only participated in one grand jury proceeding, and I would like to know, because I don't know, are the individuals who were brought in before the grand jury allowed to have counsel with them?
Chair Williams, Representative Walker, not in the grand jury room. Counsel would be outside the chamber, available for advice. If the witness were wanting to speak to their attorney, they would have to let the district attorney of the grand jury foreman know that, foreperson, know that, and then they could leave the chamber to have counsel with their attorney, but not inside the chamber.
But please, Chair Williams.
Follow up.
As I see it, then perhaps there could be a situation where individuals that are brought in very early on and have not actually had the opportunity to discuss any facts of the case with their attorney, that they would not understand perhaps when some of the members of the grand jury might be asking leading questions or other situations that might have an individual make comments or say things that perhaps they should have had counsel with prior to making those statements. Do you see a problem with that being recorded and then later used?
Chair Williams, Representative Walker, I don't see a problem with it being recorded because very possibly if they were making statements that were to incriminate themselves, is that the type of statement you're talking
about? That's one situation, yes.
My guess is, and this frankly is just a guess, my guess is if they make some kind of incriminating statement before the grand jury and they end up being indicted because of that, that the evidence would be coming out through some kind of exception to the hearsay rule and trial anyway. So I don't see that there would be a problem with the recording of that.
Follow-up, Chair Williams.
Follow-up.
What about information that may be testified to by a witness or potential witness or someone with just knowledge of a situation that is heard by the grand jury, and because they recognize that or have been told or understand that that information is just for gathering data to see if there are grounds for charging another individual, they may say things in there that could, if a tape were made available, that could make their identity not only known, but the statements known, which could then jeopardize them in some other way.
Chair Williams.
Their safety, perhaps.
Chair Williams, Representative Walker. One of the rules about the grand jury proceeding is that every witness before the grand jury is identified, and actually is the name is listed on the indictment itself. So every individual who testifies in front of the grand jury will be known to everyone when that indictment becomes public. As far as their information is concerned, because they are known, that investigative phase could potentially uncover that information. But when we get into the situation where a witness through the investigation process from defense point of view, talks to that witness, and then they do not tell us what they told the grand jury. In other words, they're keeping secrets from us. Then it's all the more necessary to have that recorded so we do know what is going on and what they've said before. It is essential for us to know that. And I hope I answered your question appropriately, but if I didn't, let me know.
Well, one follow-up, and then I'm finished. The situation that I see is where someone who perhaps has information doesn't necessarily want that information connected to them at that point in an investigation, but it's made on a tape. They may hesitate to even say it if they know it's being taped where it would be important information. Later it could be discovered other ways, but that information is not, I mean, they may be on the jury list for the grand jury. They may go in and give information knowing that it's not going to be made public or connected to them right away in regards to the indictment process. They may not want to divulge that information in the grand jury process, is what I'm saying, which may not result in indictment.
Chair Williams, Representative Walker, and I suppose that there is that potential out there. In a typical situation, from my experience with the grand jury proceedings, there will be a lag time between the testimony before the grand jury and the release of the information, either in a discovery situation, whether it be notes or an interview with the potential witness. Or in this situation where defense counsel might be able to request the tape recording of the grand jury, there will be a lag time. Now, whether that does away with the fears that you're expressing, I don't know. But it is important that, from our point of view, that in order to have fair and a fair trial for someone charged with a crime, that we be able to ensure that the grand jury proceedings are a fair process in order to get that person into court. And that's where our grand jury reform ideas are coming from, and that's the basis or the background of our requests. And we feel that that potentially is outweighs the situation that you're talking about. So, I mean, that's certainly our position anyway.
Thank you.
Further questions? Representative Lowe?
Pass the note to Bob because I didn't want to display my ignorance, but you heard my sigh, so now I'm stuck. Here I go. In the federal system, are any grand jury proceedings court reported?
Representative Lowe, it's my understanding they are. I don't have any personal experience with that, but I understand they are.
And in the state system, are there court reporters involved in any grand jury proceedings that you can think of? Not even when the grand jury is involved and it when it dawns on one brilliant grand jury that they can investigate, say, the sheriff's office or the condition of the jails or the running operations of the DA's office. They have huge, huge powers, but rarely are they informed of them, and they don't exercise them. So, and none of those proceedings are recorded?
As far as I know, no, they are not.
So this would kind of bring the state more into conformity with the federal procedure that allows for recording the grand jury proceedings?
My understanding, yes.
And can you tell me how that is working in the federal system? Does it seem to benefit one group more than another? Does it seem to cause huge proliferation of post-adjudication defense motions? And
Representative Williams, Representative Lowe, I just don't know. I'm not familiar enough. I don't practice in the federal system, and I just don't know to answer your question.
Well, I guess what I'm really asking is, will this do any good or do any harm?
Representative Williams, Representative Lowe, what I believe it will do is it will place one more check on the executive branch to make sure that when they go through the grand jury proceeding, it's done correctly. One of the things that right now is being litigated is in Josephine County an issue of whether information provided to the grand jury by people who are not listed as witnesses but as background or other types of information so that the grand jury can understand types of evidence, particularly in sex abuse cases, whether that's appropriate or not. And frankly, it was going on quite a while, and in other counties besides Josephine, but it's being litigated down there. But we didn't know. And the reason why we didn't know is because those people were not listed on the indictment as providing information to the grand jury. And I don't remember the specific information on how it came to light, but it did come to light. And that is why when our people became involved in litigation, whether that's appropriate, whether those indictments were appropriately returned by the grand jury. Again, that is one of the things that we would like to be able to check on. We want to make sure that when the grand jury proceeding is used, a secret proceeding is used, that it's used correctly. And right now there is no check on that in our system.
Thank you, Mr. Hauser. Further questions? Yes, Representative Ackerman.
Yes, I'd just like some information on the fiscal impact to the counties and who would bear that impact, whether it would be the state or the county.
I don't have the information concerning the fiscal impact. I believe that is being put together, but I don't know what it is.
Okay. Good. Thank you, Bill. Is there anyone else who wants to talk about the A7s? I sort of suspected. Mr. DeLashmit, Mr. Penn, Paul, you want to come up too? All right.
Extremely briefly, just for the record, Brian DeLashmit here representing the Oregon Council of Police Associations. Without getting into the subject area of whether the amendments are good or bad, the nature and the controversial nature of these amendments concern me being tacked onto this bill. The bill in itself, 133, is a high priority for the Oregon Council of Police Associations, and we fear that this amendment would in fact scuttle the entire bill, so we would oppose this amendment.
My name is Dale Penn. I'm representing the District Attorney Association. I have similar words that were just stated. We really like Senate Bill 133, yet if the A7 amendments are added to this bill, Chiefs of Police Association, DA Association, Sheriff Association would find themselves in a difficult position where we'd have to oppose the bill because of the problems that A7 brings to this bill, although we support everything else in Senate Bill 133. And just responding to a couple of questions that were just presented, the fiscal impact on this, although I don't believe it has been completed in this particular bill, because although there was a bill to authorize this, it didn't go forward. And however, in past sessions, this bill has been introduced, I think, every session for the last 10 years. There have been numerous hearings in the past, although I think in the last several sessions there haven't been hearings on this concept, but each time the legislature has said the fiscal impact of this process and the consequence that we will in effect add cost to our system and add cost to the indigent defense side of this equation speaks against the recording of the grand jury. In past times, I've heard a fiscal of approximately $4 million used. Again, I can't say with any certainty what that would be, but I know that has always been a problem with bringing this forward. The federal system has different rules about a grand jury, including different procedural rules, such as the use of hearsay evidence and testimony in a grand jury. There is no such process under Oregon's law to allow inadmissible evidence or hearsay that in a trial you would have to call the witness, whereas in the grand jury system and the federal system you may use hearsay. The check and balance that is presently in Oregon law that allows for the grand jury system to operate is the requirement that immediately upon charging someone, it is incumbent upon the state to produce all of the evidence that is available against that defendant. Now, one of the largest abuses of the grand jury process, unfortunately, was done by a district attorney about 7 years ago in Clatsop County. And in that situation, a district attorney who had had a romantic relationship with a person who was cited by two police officers for a traffic offense or some type of crime that was possibly going to revoke his probation, this district attorney concocted a case against the two police officers to threaten the police officers to drop their arrest of her boyfriend. That's the bottom line. She indicted both police officers for possession of narcotics. And at the arraignment, the defense attorney and the two officers said, "We're innocent. Where is the evidence? Where is the discovery?" Within 2 weeks of that indictment, the district attorney had been removed from office. The attorney general's office had been transferred in to handle the cases. And ultimately, that district attorney was convicted of perjury and I don't know all the different charges and removed from office. The reason I bring that up is, fortunately, abuses like that are extremely rare, but it brings forward the concept that check and balance of the discovery process and the requirement that the state bring forward the evidence was swift and certain. Because within a very short period of time, when there was no evidence available, action was taken. Now, this particular bill itself, A7, it has some major problems. First of all, it doesn't tell us anything about who is responsible for buying this equipment, for running the machines, and for maintaining custody of these tapes. Now, that has been a major issue in past bills. My own personal opinion is that the grand jury is a court function. They choose the grand jury. They charge the grand jury. They pay the grand jury. That would be a court function. If it is somehow going to be a district attorney function, then it's an unfunded mandate because there is no funding whatsoever provided for that type of material, the equipment to record, and then storage of the tapes, retention of the tapes. In my particular office, if I were forced to record grand jury, I would have to add a staff person to run the machine and to maintain control of those tapes. Now, first of all, the idea is that the district attorney, this is primarily a check on the district attorney's authority, then again, the district attorney should not be the person maintaining custody of these tapes, and I would say it should be a court function. But if it was put on my office, I would have to lay off an individual to do this function. And statewide, that is what we would run into. There is a problem about the drafting of this particular statute, forgetting who is responsible for this. But it says all comments and statements by the district attorney or any other person to a grand juror shall be recorded. We don't do this now with trial juries. We have bailiffs. We have court individuals who take the juries, trial juries, into the deliberation room to bring them in, check them in each morning. They have discussions all the time. And yet this mandates that any conversation, any statement shall be recorded. How do we do that? Does that mean that we put a gag rule on grand jurors and you will not be able to talk to any court staff or anyone else at any time unless there's a tape recorder going? I'm just saying in practical terms at this late date in the session, the wording of this statute is not detailed enough. Finally, I would say and argue that we are very much opposed to this and believe we would have to oppose the entire bill is because this would force the use of prelims statewide because of the negative fiscal impact it would have. Now, preliminary hearings, that can be done constitutionally, but that would add approximately 50,000 hearings to the court system that are presently not held. Those are cases that will take time of courts and court staff that are not funded at the present time. Defense counsel would charge hourly rates for handling those. That is not a funded cost now. Finally, the use of this recording, even if you have a recorded grand jury, preparation of transcripts, the ability now to file motions to attack the grand jury and then ask the judge to second guess the vote of the grand jury. We have that process now with search warrants. A judge has already approved the search warrant and said there was sufficient probable cause. But the defense really will attack that I'm not saying that's inappropriate, that is their job. To test any time there is a potential remedy, it is their job to test the system. You will provide a new remedy, and we will have those motions in all of these indictments, which will number approximately 50,000 per year. It can add hearings that would then have overtime costs for police officers, and then we will litigate this ad nauseum about whether or not the grand jury made the right decision, when in effect, the real issue is there admissible evidence to charge this individual? The trial itself is where a jury in court with a judge, with defense counsel, with cross-examination is going to determine whether or not there was proof beyond a reasonable doubt to convict this individual. We have very few directed verdict situations in Oregon. If, in fact, we were having thousands of directed verdicts, and that's where a judge, after hearing the evidence from the state, would say, there isn't enough evidence to even proceed. If there were many directed verdicts, then perhaps this idea that the grand jury is indicting people inappropriately, perhaps that would be something to examine. But that is a rare circumstance. I can count on one hand, in 10,000 cases that we prosecute a year in my county, on one hand, the amount of directed verdicts that we receive in a year. So for all of these reasons, we oppose the bill. We would be open to the idea of exploring the concept as long as there was funding, as long as there was detail about how this was done, and as long as there was some prohibition to adding a whole new layer of litigation to every felony case. But that is not contained in the A7 amendments.
Thanks, Dale. Did you get any time to relax this weekend? Stay put. We'll let Paul talk, and then we'll take some questions. Paul?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Paul Snyder, representing the Association of Oregon Counties, and I'm appearing this morning in opposition to the -A7 amendments to Senate Bill 133 for all the reasons that have already been discussed, plus a couple more. These amendments are drafted in the passive case, and so it's difficult to tell when it says the proceedings must be recorded and on the record electronically whose responsibility it is to do that. It could be a court responsibility or it could be a county responsibility. If it's a county responsibility, it's going to cost the counties a significant amount of money, and it's going to cost additional funds from the district attorney's offices in a situation where one of our top priorities is to try to accomplish additional funding for the district attorneys, and this would be moving us backwards. I would just be repeating everybody else's testimony, Mr. Chair, so I'll just stop. We oppose the amendment.
Great. Thanks, Paul. Are there questions for Paul or for Mr. Penn?
I need Mr. Penn for a couple of questions. Test your weekend preparation.
Representative Ackerman.
Yeah. Mr. Penn, I'm acquainted with the diversion programs in Lane County, what we call here early disposition, which were basically just established by the district attorney's office as a creative way to reduce caseload and yet to make defendants in this narrow band of cases responsible and accountable for their acts. Would you agree that the district attorney's offices have the authority to establish these programs now, even if this bill didn't go through?
Mr. Chair and Representative Ackerman, these are beyond the -5 amendments and the early disposition programs. The reason we believe a statute is important is that it really takes the court, the district attorney, and the defense bar to agree to do one of these programs. And in Lane County, that agreement has taken place. However, statewide, it has not. And what this does is give some guidance and maybe some gentle prodding, because we believe that's the only way the benefits of these programs would be available statewide. This idea first came up about 12 years ago on the first indigent defense task force to study indigent defense in Oregon and the costs, and it was recommended at that time, and it has been recommended statewide, but it just hasn't happened except in one or two counties.
Thank you.
Thank you. Further questions for Mr. Penn? Mr. Representative Ringo.
Thank you. On the -7, you mentioned the huge cost of recording, and I'm just wondering, what's so expensive about it? Why do you envision a bank of microphones in every grand jury room, or can't you just put a tape recorder in the middle of the table?
Well, Mr. Chair and Representative Ringo, I do believe that, again, this is recorded for a purpose. It is recorded for purpose of documenting the testimony. That means I think you're going to have a recording system similar. It doesn't need to be a court reporter, but a recording system with multiple microphones and a machine. And it's going to require staff to run that machine to make sure that it is picking up, that it is recording appropriately, and make notations, a log of who's testifying on what case at what time. And then staff to run the machine and then store the tapes, maintain the logs. And so staff cost even though there's some hundreds of thousands of dollars that would be involved in equipping all 36 counties with the recording material, the real cost is staff to maintain that, and then in the system, transcripts and the new layer of litigation.
I follow up, Mr. Chair.
Follow up.
You know, I guess I could ask Mr. Hauser whether he envisions that same sort of recording system and the intended expenses, but it sounds to me like your objection based on cost is really an excuse because you don't like the concept. You just don't like the idea that the grand jury proceedings, the charge part of it, would be recorded. And that even if we came up with the money, you'd still be here making a very concerted argument that you don't like the Dash 7 amendments.
Mr. Chair and Representative Ringo, I will tell you that I do not believe it is necessary. I've had I've had law professors, I've had defense lawyers as four persons of our grand jury. I've had Paul DeMunis, who's now in the Oregon Supreme Court, as a four-person of grand jury. He's written an article about his experiences. I do not believe it is necessary. However, to me, right now, when we are before this legislature asking for additional resources for prosecution, cost is a major factor to me right now. I do not prosecute 2,500 cases a year in this county simply because of cost. So cost is important. I don't believe it's necessary, secondly. And number three, I'm very concerned that we would add a layer of litigation that is unnecessary. That bothers me more than anything, because if I was a defense lawyer, I would feel obligated to at least introduce the tape and say, Judge, why don't you second guess what the grand jury did? And because it's available, and if I don't do it, somebody's going to raise it on post-conviction that I should have. And so those are the three objections I have.
Representative Ringo.
Well, but the tape wouldn't be of the deliberations.
No, and Mr. Chair and Representative Ringo, that's exactly what I'm talking about. The check is already there in that if there is not admissible evidence in the discovery to charge someone, I'm going to hear about it immediately, just like the situation where the district attorney tried to indict those two police officers. That's what I'm saying, is that the tape would be of the evidence and the questions and the statements that were done at grand jury. And so it really is a kind of a secondary thing. There might be sufficient evidence to indict, but, gee, you forgot to ask the venue question in grand jury. Therefore, we get to dismiss the indictment and start over again.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Penn. Okay, that's enough on the A7s for now. Why don't we bring up the A8s have been withdrawn, so let's bring up the A9s. I'd like Representative Beck and Senator Atkinson to come forward.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. For the record, Chris Beck, House District 12 in Portland, and I'm here on the A9 amendments. This was I introduced a House bill that at the request of a constituent who had been riding a bike and had been hit by a car, and so we introduced this bill to address his problem to change or improve some of the provisions relating to such instances. And I found out that Senator Atkinson had also been hit by a car and when he was riding his bike, and he's going to tell us a little bit about that maybe. And my staff, Joel Shapiro, is here to who's worked on this and can be a little more articulate than I if you have detailed questions. Thank you. Thanks.
Certainly. Members of the committee, Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Jason Atkinson, State Senator, District 25, and I'm here under my own free will to testify on Mr. Beck's nice amendment. Thank you for giving it a hearing. The bill, or the particular amendment, is interesting to me. At one point in my life, I had a bit of a cycling career that was lasted 9 years. I raced all over the world. Mountain and road bikes, and used to train quite heavily in the spring, which would lead me into racing in the summers. And my career came to an end when I went through the windshield of a Blazer one afternoon, riding outside south of Sun River. And as my head went through the windshield of the car, I realized that maybe perhaps it was time to get on with my life and go back to graduate school. But
just for the record, Senator, I think that all of a sudden explains a lot.
I was
people in this building.
I was a tax and spend Democrat before that accident. And now look at me.
You came to in the Secretary of State's office.
But anyway, the worst part of the whole accident, I got to tell you, was the bike that got hurt. It was just such a beautiful piece of artwork that I still cry and moan about it. But the bill is written, I think, put a little bit of teeth into the law. Let me tell you, some of my experiences racing and training around our country, there is a different ethic among the states with regards to cyclists. Oregon is actually pretty progressive as a state with the fact that people not only ride bicycles, but pay attention to people who do, if they're in a car. Some Midwestern states that I have been in have perhaps the worst ethic in the world. I can remember one time I was at a training camp in Ohio, and we would go out and train in, you know, the big square miles, each square being a square. And so you'd ride one way, ride one way, and we'd ride these four-sided squares. And cars would see us, like, I don't know, 6 miles away, I mean, forever, and would start honking then until they got up to us or try to swerve us off the roads or do things like that. It was a little annoying. Fortunately, there was a lot of us. Here in Oregon, occasionally you get somebody who's got some kind of vendetta that'll swerve and try to knock you down. That's only happened to me one other time besides the accident, but it is out there, and we do have a growing cycling community, and I think this is a good amendment, and this particular version is pretty reasonable. With that, I'd be more than happy to answer any questions you have about bicycles.
I do have a couple of, I guess, questions I'd like to ask. The individual who struck you, was there a fault determination there? Was somebody cited in that incident?
I think she got a formal slap on the wrist. I'm not sure what the actual citing was.
Mm-hmm.
There was a combination of the sun that was going down and her right hand adjusting the radio, I think, were the two things. Because
mm-hmm.
I actually was yelling at her not to hit me before she hit me. Don't hit me. And then she was cited by a sheriff's officer, but I forget, it was a pretty good slap in the wrist.
Okay.
But doggone it, pretzel the Eddie Merckx. It was just terrible.
There is currently in the law, under assault in the fourth degree, which is a Class A misdemeanor, which this vehicular assault that you've identified here in the Dash A9s would be the same level of crime. And that's for when a person intentionally, knowingly, or recklessly causes physical injury to another. And again, that's similar to what we've got here. You've got a reckless standard, and it's the same definition of recklessly. So I guess I'm wondering, in a situation where someone has recklessly done that, the current statute is available for that to happen. And so although this creates sort of a new particular category of crime, specifically dealing with bicyclists and pedestrians, the current assault statute would cover anybody's ability to charge that crime.
Mr. Chairman, what we're trying to do here is move that assault for statute into the bicycle and pedestrian statute as well, so that people who are in these types of accidents and who feel that there should be some charge brought, or possibly a police officer looking at what sorts of crimes they can charge, they'll go to the bicycle and pedestrian section of the law, and they will see that there is this reckless recklessness charge as well in that provision, not just the assault for statute. I'll let my able legal staff here
say that maybe more articulately than I, but...
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm Joel Shapiro. I work for Representative Beck. And I've worked on this language with other attorneys and with bicycle advocacy groups. And I guess I should mention for the record that I'm an attorney and clerked in the district attorney's office in Multnomah County, so I've prosecuted misdemeanor offenses. And the main point of this amendment is if you look in Chapter 811, which I brought a copy of, which is rules of the road for drivers. So this is the vehicle code. This is what officers typically have with them in a little flip chart when they get to a scene if they're a traffic officer. The very first section is called duties to pedestrians and bicycles. And we just feel that one of the duties to pedestrians and bicycles is don't run them over. And if you cause an injury to a pedestrian or a bicycle, it should be very clear that that is an assault and that it's intended to be charged as one. And in speaking with Ray Thomas, who is the foremost expert on bicycle law in Oregon, he's written a handbook on it, and he's a former board member of the Bicycle Transportation Alliance in Portland, and has prosecuted, or not prosecuted, but has pursued a lot of civil claims on behalf of injured bicycles. What he told me is in all of his years of doing this, which is, I don't know, approaching 20, he has only twice seen an officer issue an assault charge, an assault four, on an instance where you clearly have a serious physical injury. And that's a problem. And we're asking that the legislature, as policymakers, send a signal that when you do have an injury that is caused by a reckless behavior by a motorist, that it is charged as an assault, as it should be, and which it currently isn't. And if I can just add one more anecdote, this amendment came about on behalf of one of Representative Beck's now former constituents, who twice last year was injured while riding in the bicycle lane coming home from work at Intel to his apartment. And in both cases, the motorist was determined to be at fault. In both cases, he was unconscious at the scene and taken away by paramedics. The second time, it was determined that while he was unconscious, he was in a coma. So clearly we have physical injury to meet the assault four standard. In neither of those instances did the officer, after determining that the motorist had caused the collision, issue anything more than infraction. So it's essentially like a parking ticket or a speeding ticket when it, in fact, should properly be charged as an assault.
Sure. Representative Shetterly, then Representative Ackerman, then Representative Ringo.
Just let me ask, I guess, specific to those stories. Did the officer determine there was recklessness? I guess it's one thing to say fault, but if it was negligence or something less than recklessness, you wouldn't get a charge anyway. So I guess that'd be the question I'd have in the story you've told.
Chair Williams, Representative Shetterly, basically that would be up to the jury to determine whether it meets the standard of reckless.
Well, Mr. Chair, it's a charging decision first, I think, right. Police officer.
Well, yes, that's true, but what happens is if they only issue it as an infraction, they're not considering the elements of a criminal charge. And then my understanding is in most counties, those kinds of citations aren't reviewed by the district attorney, so they're not making a charging decision either. But by putting this charge into the vehicle code, the duties to pedestrians and bicycles, we think it's more likely that the officer would charge it that way.
Might be helpful, committee, if some of you haven't recently read the definition of recklessness from the criminal code, which this draws from. Recklessly, when used with respect to a result or to a circumstance described by a statute defining an offense, means that the person is aware of and consciously disregards a substantial and unjustifiable risk that the result will occur or that the circumstance exists. The risk must be of such nature and degree that disregard thereof constitutes a gross deviation from the standard of care that a reasonable person would observe in the situation. So that's the definition of recklessness that's being applied. Representative Ackerman?
Yes, I'm wondering why the offense of reckless driving doesn't cover the situation envisioned in Dash A9 amendments.
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman. Again, it's an instance where we're not saying that this is a completely new crime with different, where the elements of this aren't covered under something else. The problem is that where these crimes are located in the code, reckless driving is not in the duties to pedestrians and bicycles. And when an officer comes to a scene and they see a collision that occurred, they're not thinking, well, did I observe the driving and was it reckless? I mean, I've talked to officers about this, and they think of reckless driving as a pattern of reckless behavior, not one instance of a mental state of recklessness. We're not talking about reckless driving. We're talking about being able to prove the mental state of recklessness.
But you're using the same statutory definition for recklessness in the amendment as probably occurs in the definition of reckless driving. Isn't that correct?
Representative Ackerman, Chair Williams, yes, that's correct. It's also the same mental state as you would find in an assault 4, but it's not being charged.
And let me just make one comment, and because I haven't done the research on this, but it occurs to me that if you charge somebody with reckless driving and it has the same state of mind as the -A9 amendments, you might have more clout in that I believe reckless driving would be a major traffic offense and might have some very severe driving license suspension sanctions where this act or this amendment does not. If I'm correct in that, if I was a prosecutor, I'd probably prosecute for reckless driving rather than under this one because I would have some potential for driver's license suspension. I just throw that out.
Chair Williams, Representative Ackerman, that's a good point. It's a valid point. We're not trying to seek the highest punishment for anyone. We're just trying to make sure that they get one charge. And right now it's zero.
Representative Rigo.
Maybe this is all redundant. The examples you described, at least to me, sounded like garden variety negligence. And to Senator Atkinson, I mean, somebody reaches down fiddling with the radio, they cause a car accident, they're never going to be cited for reckless driving. That's just standard negligence. And as far as what Mr. Shapiro described, I mean, there was no reason to know, just based on what you described, that it was recklessness. And that's the standard we use. I mean, an officer is not going to issue a citation for recklessness without really knowing that somebody was drunk, driving way too fast, I mean, doing something really stupid. Otherwise, they're just going to get a citation. And I'm not sure that I oppose the A9s. Maybe it is useful to put them in a different section of the code, but I agree with the comments that it really doesn't add anything as far as what can already be done.
Further comments? Representative Cheryl Walker.
Chair Williams, I'd just like to make one comment, and I see where you're trying to go with this, but I think probably one of the things that says results in contact between the vehicle and the bicycles, and I used to ride bicycles, believe it or not, and in Medford I was actually run off of a residential street by some teenage kids in which I sustained concussions and severe injuries, but they never made contact with the bicycle. They were very close. So that was definitely reckless behavior on their part. They did it deliberately, but there was no contact. So I think this needs probably, if we're going to protect bicyclists, probably we need a little more work in some other areas. But I see where you're trying to go with it. I understand that.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Shetterly.
Thank you. The testimony and comments even from committee members in this proposed amendment has underscored to me the wisdom of being of not being a bicycle rider.
Well, Representative Shirley, I can say that I spent the weekend at Center River where I where I rode bikes for a considerable period of time, and I noticed as I was reading this, and Mr. Taylor pointed out to me that the person that operated that a bike is in fact a vehicle, so. There were several times that when I was on my bike having contact with the bikes around me, probably subject to this penalty.
Well, there you're being run off by tot trailers.
Hopefully no physical injuries.
Yeah, there were no physical injuries, thankfully. Okay, any further questions? We are, just so you know, we are just considering amendments today. We don't intend to move the bill until tomorrow. So, thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, and Representative Lowe for letting us bring this forward, and the rest of you, if you have other questions, try to get a hold of me or Joel, and we'll try to answer them. Thank you.
Thank you.
And for the record, I have absolutely no objections to the A9 amendment.
Thank you, Representative Lowe. The last amendment we're going to consider today is the A11 amendments. Representative Carlson, do you want to come up and just take a minute and remind us what those are about?
Thank you, Chair Williams and members of the committee. Janet Carlson, Representative District 32. The A11s may look a little bit familiar because we saw them as House Bill 3037. This is the bill that starts with the premise that crime is intergenerational and that we as a state need to do a better job of breaking that cycle. It sets up a planning and advisory committee of state and local partners, including public safety coordinating councils, family law advisory committees, local commissions on children and families, local public health agencies, and other research groups to try to come up with strategies on how we can increase family bonding for children who have parents who are incarcerated in either the state or the community correction system. When this bill came before the subcommittee of the judiciary, there was compelling testimony from researchers from the Oregon Social Learning Center that talked about parenting strategies that are being developed and that can be effective with this population, from advocates for the families, from family members themselves, and from Mr. Tom Mann, who a lobbyist in this building, who was a child of an incarcerated parent himself. There was a minimal fiscal impact with the agencies involved so that they were willing to absorb. The House passed it virtually unanimously. There was one no vote. Representative Schrader said he opposes planning and advisory committees generally, so he was opposing the bill for that reason. Otherwise, everyone was behind it. And it got to the Senate, and for some mysterious reason, there was not an opportunity for it to be heard in the Judiciary Committee on the other side. So I am respectfully requesting that you breathe a little new life into this bill and add it into this so that we can continue to see if this bill has an opportunity to be passed by both chambers this session.
Thank you, Representative. Are there questions of Representative Carlson? You'll recall, I think, the committee, the fairly extensive testimony we had on the original bill.
Thank you so much.
Thank you, Representative. Is there anybody else here to testify on Senate Bill 133 or any of the amendments that are under consideration that didn't get a chance to speak today? If not, oh, Kathy, you just can't resist, can you?
Real briefly, Mr. Chair, on the Kathy Osborne from the Juvenile Rights Project, on the A9 amendments, because motor vehicle offenses are automatically waived offenses for juveniles, if this assault was put into the vehicle code, any juvenile charge with it would be automatically waived into the adult system, and for that reason, Juvenile Rights Project would be opposing the A9 amendments because we oppose any form of automatic waiver.
Interesting. Okay. Thank you, Kathy. Any other comments? Okay, colleagues, keep checking your agenda for tomorrow, but we will bring every 133 back and several other bills back for tomorrow's meeting, which will be the last regularly scheduled meeting of the Judiciary Committee. After that, we'll meet only selectively on particular bills at the call of the chair. We're adjourned.
What time tomorrow?